Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. Time for another Friday bonus episode, and I'm kind of shocked that I got this guy. My guest is Wayne Wang, a filmmaker who helped spur the American indie revolution with movies like Slam Dance, Eat a Bowl of Tea, and his Miramax double feature Smoke and Blue in the Face. He's also made studio films like The Joy Luck Club, Anywhere But Here, and Made in Manhattan, and he moves back and forth pretty much whenever he feels the need. His latest feature, Coming Home Again, played TIFF in 2019, and it stars Justin Chan as Chang-Rae Lee, a writer who moves back to San Francisco to tend to his dying mother, played by Jackie Chung. It's now available in virtual cinemas in the U.S. and on Vimeo On Demand in Canada from Outsider Pictures. It's quiet and it's devastating, not unlike the movie Wayne wanted to talk about here. He picked John Dielman, 23 Quai de Commerce, 1080 Bruxelles, Chantal Ackerman's singular 1973 study of a middle-aged woman cycling through her daily routine. Running 3 hours and 20 minutes and featuring a performance by the magnificent Delphine Seyrig, it's a singular dramatic accomplishment, locking us in with a woman as she performs the duties expected of her, until she doesn't. This is Someone Else's Movie.
Well, I saw it when I was going to film school, and it really impressed me in that it had a whole different way of telling a story. It doesn't have your normal narrative, the normal drama. It's basically 3 days of a mother rituals through the day, basically cleaning the house, preparing the meal for her son, well, taking care of the son, basically. And then in the afternoon, she sometimes has these clients who come over and have sex with her. But that's all kind of almost off camera. But on the last day, you know, everything kind of goes wrong a little bit. A button falls off of her son's shirt when she's ironing it. She drops a clean spoon on the floor. I mean, little things that throw off her rhythm. And she kind of goes a little crazy from there. And the film is similar to Coming Home Again in that it's all a static wider master shot, and it stays for a long time, actually much longer than Coming Home Again. And you really see, you have to kind of look for your own rhythm and look for things within the frame. And it establishes, you know, that ritual and that life that she has. It's always impressed me a lot in how brave and the choices that Chantal made to make this film. So when I was doing Coming Home Again, I was thinking kind of in the same mode. I'm deeply also much more influenced by Ozu, which has the same kind of tone and pacing in a way. Where Ozu also uses a lot of empty spaces and empty objects, which he calls the emotions of the environment that's collected from the characters. So between those two, I think I came up with my inspiration for Coming Home Again. So anyway, John Dielman and Ozu, obviously, yeah.
It's an interesting, I hadn't really connected. I don't know why. I've seen John Dielman, I'm going to say, I think I've watched it in full twice, once theatrically and once three times. When the Blu-ray came out, the DVD as well, and then once in the theaters in the late 90s, maybe. And every time I'd never connected it to Ozu until you just mentioned that. But of course, he uses environmental shots the same way, and right. Ackerman just stretches it out even longer and longer.
Yes.
Ozu's films are slow, but they're short.
Yeah.
And this just gives you,
Ackerman also has less drama in a way. I mean,
yes.
Drama is in the repetition and in the ritual that she goes through. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's nothing overtly, when you try to describe it to people, or when I've tried to describe it to people in the past, I get the same thing, which is, oh, that sounds really interesting. It's how long? And you can't, you can't explain it to people, right? You have to experience it to understand how time works in the film.
Yes.
And the use of space and or not space, but the use of spacing out the narrative into the circular rhythms that she creates for us, the audience, not for the character.
Yeah.
I described it a couple of months ago, just sort of half jokingly, as the first time loop movie, but I think it is.
Yeah. Well, also for me, and this is somewhat related to Coming Home Again. Also for me, it's the acceptance of the silence and the pacing without a lot of words, without a lot of action. You know, these days we're so used to seeing, oh, there's dialogue, there's drama, there's this going on. I remember going to see my mother when she was towards the end of her being sick, and I would just go sit with her in the courtyard in the sun, usually if there is any, and we would sit there and not talk. Because every time we talk, it gets into, you know, a lot of frustrations from my end, at least. Mm. We didn't talk for an hour and we just sat in silence. And that silence spoke even more in the end.
Yeah.
And I think the silence is very much part of John Dielman, even though she has a lot of ambient sounds, but it's also kind of a certain kind of silence. And my film also has a lot of silence with the ambience again. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Coming Home Again, because it's about palliative care, it struck me as being very, there's a tentativeness to the interactions, even when people are carrying decades of resentment or just issues, not even necessarily resentments, but just the inability to connect with someone you've lived your whole life with.
Yeah.
I found that really powerful, but that the fact that someone is ill changes the air in the room, I found in my life. You know, when you're when you have that sort of, it's not foreboding exactly, especially at the point of the illness and the story that you're telling. It's just about accepting that this is something nobody can change, and the resignation has its own weight, I guess, emotionally.
Yeah.
Jean Dielman doesn't have that. It builds towards something that we can't understand, which is different, but equally compelling, I think. And you know, you were mentioning that Coming Home Again is influenced by Jean Dielman, but it's also almost a third the length. So you're dealing with all of this time that's compressed into 86 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the film, it takes place over a matter of weeks, but of course it's encapsulating the decades of the relationship of a mother and a son. Jean Dielman tells us all of these things, but it takes place, as you said, over a handful of days in much more time. And it's just such a fascinating contradiction that you can make an hour feel like a day if you want to. And so many filmmakers choose to go for more rapid fire cutting and just more aggressive storytelling. And your film moves back and forth in time as well. And you still get the sense that you're experiencing the totality of these lives.
Yeah.
How do you arrive at that?
I went through so many years working on studio films. I'm not that I don't like them. I learned a lot doing them. But, you know, in those films, towards the end of the editing, I mean, the studio will always say, well, there are all these scenes where at the end of it, the characters are not saying anything and nothing is happening, cut it out. But once you realize when you do that a lot and you cut out all those scenes in the film doesn't breathe anymore. It just keep pushing it along. And then I was feeling slowly towards the last, you know, part of my career there, I was finding myself kind of not always tired. I couldn't sleep. I had headaches and I went to see my doctor. My doctor said, you're not breathing right. You're not breathing. And that's the same thing about the film. You got to let the film breathe. And that's what I learned very early on with Jean Dielman. Even though it's much longer and it gets a little boring, but you accept it and you have to learn how to breathe with it, you know? And that's Coming Home Again. I'll tell an audience, you know, just go with the rhythm and breathe. Let the film breathe with you.
Yeah, it trains you to watch it in a way. Both films do, I would think.
Yeah. I think Jean Dielman trains you to a certain routine So that when the routine breaks down a little bit, you begin to feel it. Because otherwise, yeah. I think it'll come too dramatic almost.
Anyway, yeah, it has to be. Yeah, it has to be so subtle in the way that it starts to crack, right? Because otherwise, you just shock. It would be too much of a shock.
Yeah.
And the.
But at the same time, I'm watching. I mean, the pandemic has brought me to serial TV. I didn't used to watch any TV, but I've been watching mostly European ones, but still they're really well done, and I'm completely sucked in by them. I mean, series like Le Bureau, or actually an American one, which I find quite interesting, is Ozark. I mean, some of it gets a little over dramatic, but generally speaking, I would say it's some of the better, you know, American writing. I mean, besides Soprano and Mad Men, I mean, I would put this one pretty close to those other two. Anyway.
That's interesting. Athena, Rachel Sangari brought up Ozark on the podcast not 2 months ago, 3 months ago, I guess, in July, and said that she was similarly sucked right in and had binged most of it in Georgia in quarantine.
Right.
I wonder if people are just discovering it all of a sudden.
Yeah.
It's the show of the moment. I was going to ask if you'd seen Patriot, which is an Amazon series that only ran two seasons.
I have not seen that. Maybe I will write it down and I will look into it.
Yeah, it's similarly dependent on time. It stretches itself out in its incidents, and it takes a great deal of leisure time getting to where it's going. But all of these feels. It always feels conscious of its length, of its running time. And storytelling now, as you said, the impulse is to go to high speed, cut, and get to the end as fast as you can. But something gets lost. Jean Dielman wouldn't be half as interesting at half the length, I think. You would just wonder why you were sitting there.
Yeah.
And Ackerman just had this singular perception of what the audience could stand. Right. I mean, thinking about something like Letter from Home, where it's deceptively banal almost, and then you realize that the context is what makes it so powerful, or the Rendezvous of Anna, where again, it's a series of small repetitive sequences, just the locations change, but they don't really. And it's up to us to figure out how the character changes from room to room.
Right.
Yeah, as a storytelling conceit, it's a big leap to isolate an audience with someone and as you pointed out, to do it as statically as possible.
Right. And also basically one location. I mean, we went outside once in the beginning where he runs up the hill. That's it.
Yeah, that's it. Otherwise we never get to leave the house. Jean never gets to leave the house.
Right.
It's the world keeps coming to her, and maybe that's why she has to destroy it. But I've seen it, you know, a number of times, and I still don't really know why. I know why. I mean, you have a sense of why.
Right.
But I love the fact that we are denied any kind of monologue or, you know, title screen that just explains everything. What was Psycho was what? 13 years earlier, and they felt the need to stick on that epilogue with the psychiatrist explaining everything for 6 minutes.
I know.
And Ackerman
that's the beauty of Jean Dielman, is that you can feel it, but it's not that specific. I mean, everyone can feel the frustration of what's lacking in their lives, and you use almost your routine as a way of denial. You know, there's a bit of all of that in Coming Home Again too. So anyway, it's so interesting, you know. That's why the same thing. I mean, I shot Coming Home Again in sequence, every scene in sequence.
Really? That's...
Yeah, because it was small enough, it was one location, I was able to do it. I remember, you know, Terrence Malick actually had the luxury on the Ben Affleck film, he actually built two sets exactly the same, so he could shoot in the morning on one and then in the afternoon on the other, because the light changed and he used natural light. Anyway, I didn't have that luxury, but I still could kind of control it enough to shoot it in sequence. But I remember Justin feeling, he kept coming to me and said, "Oh God, I'm feeling so full of tension and nothing is going on." I go, just go with it, go with it. And then towards the end, he just couldn't take it anymore. And he just blew up and let go.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can feel that. I mean, it's, there are films that feel airless, that, mm-hmm. you know, where everybody is so poised and so specifically blocked and all the lighting is just so that there's no room for life to enter the frame. And Coming Home Again doesn't have that. Coming Home has a much more, it has a heartbeat that it's erratic. It's yeah. you're constantly afraid of the release of tension.
Right.
And when it,
that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it would be. I don't want to, I will go into the ending for the sake of the audience, but when it happens in the film, it's really uncomfortable in for a viewer. It feels almost too intimate that I'm seeing something I shouldn't see.
Well, the moment that it was really building up for Justin was when the mother, towards sort of the end, before the very last part, when they're preparing the final part of the meal, she actually says to him, "I probably shouldn't have sent you away after all of this, right?"
Yeah.
And he goes, "Why?" And she goes, "You know, because I didn't know I was going to die." And I think Justin was ready to throw the whole rice cooker at her at that point. Anyway, but it was kind of interesting watching that build very slowly.
Yeah. Well, what's it like to be on the set for something like that? And, you know, past a certain point, there's really very little you can do when the scene is happening. Do you know when it's happening? Do you know when you're getting it? Can you feel it in the room when it's working properly?
I can feel it in the room very well, because it's so, again, so few people, so quiet, and we didn't relight a lot. We shot pretty much from the master's static point of view. So there's no disruption, so to speak. You're really focused on the scene, on the characters, and on that moment. So I think in that sense, it was very concentrated and undiluted. And I really enjoyed working that way. And there were days where things weren't working, and there are always those days. And in normal studio shooting, you just plow through it and just do something that's wrong, that you know it's wrong. You go home at night and you just can't sleep. But here we were able, I think there were a couple of days, because we had such a short schedule, we were able to just say, it's not right, let's not shoot today. Let's figure out what the problem is. And then we came back the next day and did something a little different and changed that. And it started to work, you know? So you can't force something that's sort of artificial and not right onto a film like this, Coming Home Again, which is something I really appreciate. Whereas with a Hollywood film, you can kind of fake it, so to speak, through it.
Yeah, I mean, you've got enough money to fix it in post, right? Yeah. Or at least to convince yourself that you can.
Yeah, or you have so much coverage, you can kind of cut around it or something. But here, this is what it is. The scene is this. That's it.
Yeah. I just, again, you keep coming back to the reality that there is nothing so powerful as a person in a frame, on a screen, just showing you who they are.
I think Justin has that quality about him. He really wasn't afraid. I mean, you know, the end scene where he climbs over the mother, pulls her hairpiece off and climbs all over her, that's a pretty brave thing too. I mean, you know, the mother is almost like Mother Mary. You never kind of fuck her up.
Yeah. No, there's a certain kind of...
Yeah. But it reminds me of a Michael Haneke film also, where, you know, I think it was Isabel Huppert, who really loves and hates her mother. And towards the end, she just went after the mother in the bed. They even sleep in the same bed every night. And in the end, she kind of climbs over the mother and chokes her and tries to kill her.
Yeah.
Anyway, Anyway, I'm diverting now.
No, it's all relevant. Yeah. And Haneke and Huppert have that rapport. They've worked together so many times, and and Ackerman and Delphine Seyrig had to build that for Dielman. How do you talk someone into this project? I mean, just it's one of those things. I haven't really seen any writing on the relationship that you have to form for something like that, where an actor has to trust the director so much that she'll do nothing, just exist in that frame for all that time.
When I cast them, I didn't say this kind of thing. But once we started shooting, I literally said to both of them, I don't want you to do anything. Please, just let your character be in the moment. I don't want you to do anything. And with Asian actors, that's really difficult. And I think both of them kind of understood it once I said that, and they relaxed so that they're not trying to perform every day, you know, or not try to perform in every scene. I really learned that through the years, is that, you know, if actors don't try to act, they're really good actors, most of them.
The ones you can just be.
Yeah, just be and just do the action and say your lines, you know. So anyway, that was something that I think was kind of crucial. And I learned that previously in another film called 1,000 Years of Good Prayers. And I had really good actors again, and they were for days, everything was wrong, and I couldn't figure out why it was wrong. Until I just started, you know, taking the older man and just say, I'm not going to shoot any dialogue. I just want you to play like Jacques Tati and do things and try to be a little funny, but not try too hard, and just do things that are wrong, you know? And that helped me get there in that, you know, they weren't acting. They weren't trying to be something.
Right. Has that evolved as a strategy, or does it only work for certain projects?
I learned that probably through after working in Hollywood. I haven't tried that as a strategy back in a studio film or a bigger budget film. I have a feeling it will not work. Except if you have really smart actors. I mean, I remember every single actress or actor brought their own coaching teacher. So they had their acting teacher there, and the acting teacher, to make their money, they have to tell them, oh, this is your motivation and psychology here, and this is what you need to do. And they're like puppets trying to act that character. So if I went up to Jennifer Lopez and said, Jennifer, don't do anything. I mean, I'm going to get into a big battle with producers and then the acting coach and all of the acting coach was supposed to be one of the best in New York. So I don't know. I mean, I'd love to try that. But I know Ralph Fiennes will be on my side, because Ralph's whole thing was that in the morning he would do his yoga and then he would do his voice. So he would do this drone thing to get his voice and get his throat loose. And then he didn't do anything. The thing that was really important for Ralph was right before we shoot, he wanted to build his character from the exterior, not from the interior. I mean, the actor's workshop is all about the interior. Ralph just wanted, what did my clothes look like? What did my shoes feel? What glasses should I wear? He was building it. I couldn't understand it in the beginning, but later I got it, which is he began to see his character through what he looked like. Anyway.
Yeah. So the choices externally. Yeah, I get that. I mean, people talk about period films where once they're in costume, they can better understand how to move, how to feel, just because they couldn't relate to it as contemporary people.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. The process of actors just is something so alien to me. And I've talked to hundreds of them over the years, maybe even thousands at this point. I've been doing this for 30 odd years. And I keep coming back to something Robert Duvall said once, which was just that there is no trick. You just have to find yourself in the character and then be that guy.
Yeah.
And he said it like it was so simple. And it's just like, yeah, okay, but that doesn't explain all the things that your face and your body have done in these movies that are so radically different that, you know, who's the real, where it, he, his theory would seem to suggest that if you watch all of Robert Duvall's movies, you'll find Robert Duvall.
Yeah.
But I've met Robert Duvall and he's none of those people. So it's just, it's fascinating to me.
Yeah. Well, same thing. I remember Walter Matthau was interviewed after he won the Academy Award for one of those roles. And the person was asking him, so you were so good in that scene. It was so emotional. What did you do? What did you think about? How did you act that scene? And he goes, you know, I was thinking about all the laundry I have to do later on.
I wish I understood this. It is a kind of magic. I just don't get it.
It is a kind of magic, you know. You do need experience. You do need to understand the characters. You know, that's why, you know, again, Duvall was talking, you have to do your homework, and then you get on set and you try not to do anything. You just try to be the character in that situation.
Yeah. With Coming Home Again, you have Justin Tron playing a real person, or a version of that person. And so is there an additional weight there for him? Did he get
him.
Notes from the real person?
He didn't care what the writer was like, Chang Rae Lee in this case. Mm-hmm. He saw the character in a certain way, and we talked about it a little bit, and he said, I'm just gonna do this my way, because I'm not Chang Rae Lee and I can't try to get inside Chang Rae Lee's head. And Chang Rae didn't mind much either. He said, basically, this is biographical. You guys can take it and do whatever interpretation you want. I think maybe Chang Rae was a little bit surprised by the ending and how kind of explosive it got, because in the short story, it was basically everything just happened. The mother threw up a little bit and that was it. And for a film, it would be too flat. So he actually came in at that point when we got to the end and he helped us write some of that stuff too. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you're getting just, and of course the short story version of it is, I mean, I've read it. It's just elliptical and it's really more about feeling. And you don't, because you're not dealing with the nuts and bolts of it, you know, at no point in the short story do you have to contend with the fact that there's an IV unit sitting in the middle of the room between these people.
Yeah.
It's, God, what that would have been like for him. Okay. So you're telling a fictional version of this person's story, but he's coming in to help you figure out how to end it. Do you feel an additional level of responsibility when that happens, or is it just too absurd to contemplate?
I do. I myself was much more conscious of that. And he had seen a rough cut of the film too. And I think he wasn't quite sure about what he saw. So, and I can understand that because it is so biographical and it is a little different. So I was conscious of it, but at the same time, I wanted to push it the way Justin and Jackie has sort of pushed the characters. So actually, I remember one morning, Chang Rae came in to the set, and then Jackie and Justin, we all talked, and we kind of got to a point where we all agreed to disagree, kind of. But we got what we needed from that meeting, and then, you know, went on from there.
So it's just about building it out.
I would say the ending part, the ending maybe 10, 15 minutes was much more created on the moment.
Really?
Yeah. So, well, that was a direction that we all knew where it was heading. And that's where, again, you know, I my relationship with my parents is not all hunky-dory. I mean, I love them, I respect them, they love me maybe a bit too much, especially my mother, but there's a lot of, you know, frustration and unresolved feelings and things like that. And I knew that that's where it was kind of taking me with this piece too. And I can't just be respectful to what was written on the page, because like you said, it's much more elliptical, it's abstract, it's more like a poem than anything else. So in this case, I was building towards a stronger feeling that I didn't put my finger on consciously, and I used the actors to get to that point, and then we let it explode that way.
Yeah, which again comes back to John Dielman, right? You can do the same thing if you're careful about your structure. You can end it ambivalently, ambiguously, eerily, as long as the path is set, as long as the audience has been brought along to that point, we'll accept whatever you choose to give us.
Yeah.
And the final question on the podcast is always the same, which is, is there anything of John Dielman that you've used in your own film? But we've just spent half an hour talking about that explicitly. So it feels like...
I think that there's another thing that I used a lot is like in John Dielman, oftentimes the main character would step out of frame and it'll be an empty frame. Mm-hmm. And you can still hear the ambient sound. Sometimes it's her doing something outside of frame, or it was just silence. And the empty frame was so powerful to me too. And that's also relates again back to Ozu. I mean, I used a lot of empty frames in Coming Home Again. Empty frames that sort of contain all the frustrations, the emotions of the characters, empty frames that sort of contain the world itself, that you can read into it. I mean, I really, more and more so after doing the big storytelling films, it's to kind of not try to figure out what the audience want, but also give them kind of more a canvas where they can make what they want to make. That's difficult, you know?
Yeah. But
I find that films have not challenged the audience in that way at all. And I think, you know, even going back to the Jean-Luc Godard days where he went overboard, but there were some films in his career where he was really trying to change the way he told the story, the way he used the image. And I still believe in that you want, there's so many different ways you can literally make a film and tell a story or not tell a story or use the narrative, that I think it's important to explore them in some way without getting overly indulgent. So that's kind of the balance. And sometimes I feel, looking at a film like John Dielman and whatnot, I feel like I may have learned too much about how to make a film so that I have to unlearn all that. It's the same thing as actors telling them not to act. I have to learn to not know how to make a film and just, you know, trust my instincts more, to go back to what's more raw, you know? So that's something that's really more and more important as I get older.
Yeah. Shake off the past and find something new.
Yeah.
My thanks to Wayne Wang, whose excellent new drama Coming Home Again is available to stream today at virtual cinemas in the US and on Vimeo On Demand in Canada. You can find the specifics at outsiderpictures.us. Thanks also to Kelly Hargreaves. She knows what she did. Wayne's not on Twitter, but you can find John Dielman on Blu-ray and DVD in the Criterion Collection and streaming on the Criterion Channel, along with a number of Chantal Ackerman's other films. It's also available on Apple TV and streaming on Canopy in the US. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com, where in addition to writing about film and television, I'm hosting a bunch of podcasts these days. Go check them out. And you can find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. Every little bit helps, it truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network while you're at it. stay inside, watch movies, wear a mask if you go out. I'll see you next time.